Welcome to a new episode of Artist on Air. Today we share with you a recording from a growth panel on the Artist Summit featuring Julian Mattes, Paolo Negri, Rolf Zimmer, Zoe Fabienne, interviewed by Alexander Brühl. Hi guys, today we don't have the classical interview. Instead, we have Alexander Brühl from SaaS Garage interview to growth founders and to growth investors on the question of new user acquisition with retention. Can you build on the leaky bucket? The panelists actually discuss if it's more suitable to focus on acquiring new customers or on retention in times of constrained capital. I think that's a super relevant question also in these days. So please join me in listening in to one of our panel discussions from the Artist Summit. And yeah, I wish you a lot of fun.
Our moderator is founder and owner at SaaS Garage, the pre-seed angel fund for SaaS startups. Please give a warm round of applause first to Alexander Brühl.
Thank you. So I can actually save the introduction about the panel. You did that already. Thanks a lot for our topic here. I think we have really the absolute experts from both sides of the table here at our room. So I'll make a quick introduction on that, and we will really hear the story from the horse's mouth. So let's start with Zoe Fabian, expert in growth investment for a decade, she said. I don't know how you made that with a decade. Can see it. Anyway, but she focuses on B2B SaaS and started her career actually at Blackstone in Paris and in New York. Until recently, Zoe was managing director at Eurosia Growth. They invested around about 25 to 100 million per deal. And she's actually now off to new ventures. And I tried to squeeze out a little bit more information, but she actually told me that we all have to be patient, but we will hear news very soon, so stay tuned. Next one actually is Julian, another expert in growth type of investments. He actually is a partner at Itrium, formerly known as Digital Plus, a pan-European growth fund, right now I think 750 million latest or current fund. And actually I know him from a transaction and I know him in action, so I can confirm he's a real expert because he was also involved at the sale and actually at building up risk methods. And that gets me actually to, let me say one sentence more actually to you. Prior, Julian actually held positions at McKinsey. He was at Deutsche Bank. And among others, actually, he's a PhD from Goethe University in Frankfurt, right? So now moving over to Rolf, classical engineer like myself. So he studied actually computer science and economics. He held executive roles in large organizations for procurement and customer relationship management at Siemens, Ariba, and mTORIS and IBM. mTORIS was probably the one that fits most to risk methods because I guess this triggered the thoughts about his him funding risk methods. This was in the year 2012. This is where we started to actually first time meet each other. And he started this with his colleague and his co-founder, Heiko. He actually, within Risk Methods, was in charge of product management, customer services, and finance. The interesting thing is actually, and he will tell us a little bit more about that, this was already a little bit, let's say, the tension between the two founders. The one guy was on purely on sales, getting up to new customers, of course, acquisition, whereas Rolf was more the guy who said, listen, I have customer support, customer success, so I need to focus on that. And in between were the investors who said, well, we have the money, but not for both, so we need to make a decision. Keeping it simple. Now, actually, moving to the gentleman on your left. Paolo comes from Milano, where he studied mechanical engineering, and he developed a really big passion for Linux and for open source. And as he told me, Paolo, this triggered your passion for that, and it actually triggered your thought that you want to build your career, basically.
Totally, yeah. I chose a different career, not in mechanical engineering.
Not in mechanical, but at least in engineering, right? Yeah, yeah. So in 2012, same year actually, he started a company. You may have heard about this company. It's Contentful, and he started that with Sasha. Since then, actually, he has very successfully been the CTO of Contentful, and he is actually the core brain of the very, very first headless content management solution. So that is, let me say it in Italian, adesso salutiamo Paolo Negri.
Hey, everyone.
So before we start, actually, I know it's not our topic here, but I think it's a little bit interesting for us to calibrate. How many of you, to just get a little bit the mood here, how many of you believe that actually we are not in good times? We all know that, right? How many of you think that 24, and assuming that many of you are also in growth type businesses, that 2024 will open up actually for larger exits and for IPOs? Just raise your hand if you believe that this statement is true. So if I look around, this is basically 3 to 4 people from around about, I don't know, 50, 60, so a very small number believes in that. So this actually shows us that the topic that we are discussing is quite important. How can you survive? How can you grow your business actually without actually taking, you know, more money from an IPO or getting acquired and getting more money from your acquirer? So let me ask the same question actually to our panel here, because these are the experts. So what do you believe, actually? Is 24 the year where we can, and this is probably a question also for the investors here, will 24 open up the window for some of the big growth companies, or will we have to wait a little bit more?
That is very helpful. Thank you. I think that's the overarching question. I mean, we just witnessed a couple of IPOs, and if we think about this as an exit opportunity, we've seen that it can work, but it can also be very challenging. I mean, now we're at a SaaS conference, so we don't need to talk about Birkenstock, but we can talk about the fact how you market a business and how you go out there and how much you actually base yourself on maybe a fun story and something that people find interesting versus the actual numbers, and that you can annoy the market by basing your valuation on EBITDA and not net income. So, but back to what that actually means, it means that expectations are extremely high, which is why the topic that we have here today is so relevant, because there's just no way around building a company that scales efficiently, that continues to grow. And obviously we've seen some of the success stories also listing. So yes, there can be an opportunity, but at least what we've seen now on the market hasn't proven that it's a definitively open window. I think this needs more time. Strategic side, great time to look at it. As an investor, amazing time to be investing. So I'm very positive on that. But purely on the IPO side, I think the bar is extremely high.
Julian, yeah.
Yeah, I'd also say it's great time for great companies. So if you're a great company looking at Lean IX and looking at like having the right unit economics, I think it's a great time, especially as you said, on the strategic side of things. Can you currently bet on IPO, and is 2024 potentially the year for it? I'd potentially not recommend anyone going only that track, because it's very much if you can find strategics and potentially more than one being interested in you, yes, it can be great times. However, looking at the overall market and the changes also that are currently happening, I think hopefully we are seeing soon, but not, to be honest, very optimistic that it's very soon, better times in terms of the overall market.
Mm-hmm. So coming to the two entrepreneurs here, to set the stage actually, how did you operate your companies, let's say, in the ARR heydays, where the money was actually loose? So you got money from the investors, and probably the only question was, how much money does doubling your revenues cost? And the investors would basically go to their LPs, and they would say, great, let's do it. We have multiples of 15 to 20 on the ARR, so this investment is worthwhile. This should also give you a little bit a chance here, that both of you actually to talk a little bit about how you grew your companies. Actually, Contentful, quite known. Risk Methods actually was acquired last year by Sphera, very nice exit to a large organization in the United States. So tell us a little bit how this journey went, Rolf and
Paolo. Well, okay, then I'll start. I would rephrase the term it was super simple to raise money. You know, it sounds like, you know, people were waiting in the backyard and throwing money at us, right? Not really.
Not for 12.
But I do admit that probably times are tougher now than they used to be. So risk methods was from the very beginning was a clear growth game. Yeah. Really, growth over profitability. Honestly, the predominant driver for us was really how can we achieve the growth rates year over year that are expected from investors in the market in order to probably then do which we finally did then an exit at the end of the day, profitability again was not let's say the major concern we had from a management perspective. It worked out well at the very end. It depends on how your exit strategy looks like, right? Because if you find a strategic buyer who actually then sees together with the growth rate all the synergy potentials that lie in the company, and then by combining the two companies and taking out, let's say, the overhead and then making this company profitable within, let's say, just 6 months or so, that can still work out. But we all know, I think, at the moment that times are different now and profitability has become a much, much, much more, much more attention, let's say.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I second Rolf on the fact that was work raising money, but for sure, yeah, the times are challenging. And maybe to give a bit of context, because I think it's also important to understand which sort of business I'm involved with, in order to also understand some of the answers today. Contentful established the concept of headless content management. Today we are a composable platform, and 30% of the Fortune 500 companies use Contentful. So we are in the enterprise market business, software as a service. We are a venture-backed business starting in 2012, actually here in Berlin. That's where our story started and continues. And I will say, yes, there has been, obviously, well, at the very beginning, of course, no, it's mostly a on-promise sort of approach. So you need to grow, you need to prove that you can sell, and there isn't so much attention on profitability. That wasn't for sure in focus in the early stage. But I have to say, as the company matured and we went through the C series and D funding round and so on, there hasn't been a focus, I will say, on profitability, but for sure on balance of the business. That Contentful has always been quite disciplined. I think as a B2B boring software as a service company, we've always been guided towards a balance. So growth was the number one objective, but that always paying attention on what is your CAC payback period and the business metrics. So I think we've been quite educated since the beginning, and this made a Contentful a business that maybe in good times is not the super rocket ship that everyone is looking at, but also when things turn down has never been the business that immediately peaks down. And about again, the years that were positive, there was a lot of focus on growth. And what is interesting for Contentful, new acquisition is not only acquiring new customers, but it's also acquiring new use case for content management at the same customers. So we were always very focused on winning new projects in which Contentful could be used, again, at existing logos that the company had a relationship with, or gaining new logos, but the action was similar. And again, we will certainly play an aggressive game saying we must grow and we can sacrifice some mechanic in the business in name of growth. Like today, very different. Today we look at really balance, and rule of 40 that we're going to touch is one thing very much on our radar, and margins, which luckily we've always been in a good position, but margin is considered somehow, our holy grail that we really track, very different from the days when dynamics were different. And you really also observe that you can't abstract yourself from the market, like you're always, in the game, and the market influences everyone directly or indirectly. So yeah, different play these days. But again, for B2B SaaS, I think is maybe a smoother journey than other companies that have been more aggressive.
So let's then now, since we know how they operate in the past, right, let's move actually to the future. And I would like to start this actually with asking you something. I've prepared two statements, and I think probably only one makes sense for each of you. So don't raise your hand for both. I guess that doesn't make sense. So the first statement, actually, to just see how you think about, you know, growing your business. First statement would be, retention is the new growth. And the second statement would be, you can build a healthy growth on a leaky bucket. So leaky bucket, of course, meaning that actually you're losing customers. So statement one, who supports statement one? Retention is the new growth. Looks like we have a number of people there. And who would say we can still build a growing business even with some leaky bucket? About two or three people as well. Pardon?
A lot of people.
Okay. Okay, so let's see now what these people have to say to that, right? So let me start with a statement, actually, and it did come, I will disclose it later, right? It did come from one of the two operational guys here. Alexander, let's assume a 5% churn with an average ARPA of 60K euro. One sales rep closes four deals of this. So basically, if you run a 1 million company, 1 million ARR company, this means that with a 5% churn, we would have 50K churn, right? One customer loss, basically, which is something that we can actually cover basically with our existing sales organization, right? So one closing one deal more, we can cover it. So now let's take this thing and talk about growth, because growth is not a 1 million company. Growth is probably a 10, 20, 30 million. Let's take the same example and run a 10 million ARR company, take the 5%, and then you're talking suddenly about 500K of churn. And if you take that further, and I spare you all the details here, this means basically that you need two additional salespeople to just catch up with your churn and basically with your loss of ARR. So two additional salespeople in a 10 million company doing nothing else than coping up basically with your losses. Rolf, this was one of your statements. I remember when we discussed the risk method stories. Actually, I was one of the angel investors there, so I remember that. Anything to add now? Is this still, I mean, I guess this is also an indirect answer to my question, which I had to the audience before. Can you build on a leaky bucket? I think this already answers it. It's quite tough, but anything to add to that?
No, you can't, by the way. So, no, it really kills you. Your churn, that is probably not that important from an absolute numbers perspective when you are still small. It kills you then in the end, because it's anyway tough enough when you have a larger base to grow from, right? In year four, year five, you probably have 3 million, you have 4 million ARR, and then, you know, the expectation is still to grow at least by 50% or so. You know, every little revenue churn percentage is so much hurting you, and so much more than ever before, right? So it, from my perspective, you know, taking care, real care of customer retention, and we will talk about also the measures to take in order to improve that, is absolute key for both growth, but as well as for surviving as a company. Because at the end of the day, it also, the question is, you know, what's your profitability, what's your runway, and depending on that, that can make the difference. Yeah.
Perhaps, like,
sure,
if I may, but I'm going in the picture for me would be, are you actually able to play offense or defense? So stay in the sports mode. You can have the best offense ever, but if in the end a lot of goals are actually scored on your side, and you see it on the German national team currently, so you see it Bayern Munich, so a couple of these things. So if you're actually not focusing on that combination, it can never work. So the question is, are you actually able to play offense? Because I think you really have to earn it. And that's to your point, if you're actually good enough in terms of having some way up in terms of retention, then, of course, you can actually go out and attract new customers. But the question is always, these things have to hold to some extent in the balance. Because, like, staying in the picture, you will never ever win a match just by scoring a lot if on the other side you are actually losing also to a lot of, like, the opponents.
The only time I like churn is when you drop customers that are like not accretive to margin. I mean, we've seen that in the past, right? Companies grew so fast that you accepted terms that were unsustainable, or you sold something to somebody who actually couldn't really use it. I mean, getting rid of that and cleaning up your ARR of something that is not sustainable anyhow, like that's the only moment where I am happy to see churn, like this works, then you can understand it. Otherwise, obviously, it doesn't make sense to actually accept that and rather retain and frankly also do the product work to understand like why are we losing people? Are we not investing enough in product? Are we not really competitive in the market? And this is something that I was also thinking about when you gave your very good answer as to how exit opportunities look like. At the end of the day, you want to have optionality, and from my experience, optionality always comes from being in a position of category leadership, of continuously investing in product and proving yourself. And this will appeal both to strategics. It will also appeal to private equity, depending on which like segment you're in and how your numbers overall stack up. And it will be interesting for public markets. So I think it's such a good North Star to continue to do that. And I think that has been a great opportunity to really look at churn and spend a lot of time on it, if there is any. And most of the businesses obviously have some form of churn.
This actually gets me to a rather widespread statement that you can find. Of course, you can Google it, but I heard it actually from some experts as well. And actually, good question for Paolo then. A 5% increase in customer retention can boost your overall revenue by 95%. Is that the strategy at Contentful, or what? How do you see that statement?
I mean, I wouldn't say that alone is a strategy, but for sure it's been a strong component. And maybe what is interesting the Contentful business is that we don't think about retention as purely, preserving revenue or preserving the use case. But essentially, in the relationship that we have with the customer, we always think about what are the platform use cases. And when we get to contract renewal and so on, what we think is about, well, which other use cases of the customer I can think about. So we always have a retention motion that, if you want, is also a new market motion in the customer. So I cannot envision only the retentive action of retention being the strategy. It is true that helps in, like Rolf was saying, it is a nightmare. Like, if you cannot retain the use cases that you already won and you lose traction there, you end up doing a lot more work to basically staying still. And that becomes expensive and obviously has an impact on the whole cost structure in the company. But instead of thinking about retention again on, it depends a bit by the structure of the product and the business, but thinking my retention is to keep on building the relationship with the customer and keeping on understanding how do I help the customer more. It has been one of the secrets of Contentful, and that's how we grew. We approached the enterprise very early, but it's not that we were into the enterprise, and now as we keep on working, we get deeper and deeper and we understand what we can do more there. So working on an existing relationship has been a very important factor for Contentful over time.
One thought now, if you talk about, let's say, an aggressive retention strategy, what goes around in my head is actually your retention means you're talking to existing customers, right? They already have your product. So let's assume now the two companies here, you have happy customers, right? So now you want to do upsell to them, right? Doesn't that mean that you have to invest more in R&D to make them happy? Because they already use your product, right? So you want to sell them more. You want to sell them a new product. Yeah. You want to expand the revenues.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, so just last statement on that. What this means, if I just think about that, it means that you're buying, of course, the revenues, the retention, you get it, but you're paying for it on the R&D side, as an example, not only R&D.
Yeah, it needs investment. Again, if you want new use cases, you need to understand, is the platform usable as is also for these new use cases, or are there aspects that need to be added and so on? So it does influence how you think about our research and development activity, for sure.
But that's, I think, a tricky situation. I mean, I'm actually interested to hear your thoughts on that. It doesn't come for free. This is my personal opinion, right? You cannot just say, let's go for aggressive retention strategy and we just do it, right? As you confirmed now, it takes money, right? You have to adjust your product. You have to do more. You have to make your existing customers even more happy. You have to motivate them to basically buy more from you. So are you then willing, would you say, yes, we have to be willing as investors to invest more in those companies in order to basically drive retention? Or would you just expect retention comes just by switching the lever over from aggressive acquisition to aggressive retention?
from my experience, there's a couple of kind of levels of investments you will want to pull, and some of them you can basically measure, similar to marketing efficiency, when you go out for new. I mean, when you look to drive retention and expansion, essentially, of accounts, you need teams to do that. And you, by the way, also need to incentivize your teams in the right way for them to actually be incentivized to drive these upsells and drive the retention, et cetera, and really probably also separate the teams that are hunting and those that are farming. But this is not on... This is on the go-to-market side. On the R&D side, as you heard me speaking before, I'm really passionate about product investments. When I think back about companies that I invested in the past, those that really excelled on the product side, that continuously invested, in my experience, have built up that strategic value. So I would say, as long as you can tie back R&D investment to the business cases, and I love seeing... management teams think about that in a way, in terms of, you know, ideally the CPO or the CTO thinking about ARR impact and really working very closely with the go-to-market teams as to how this comes together. I think that can be so powerful. Then that actually compounds over time as it increases your TAM. And here I'm coming back to how I would think about an opportunity for a company to go public. Of course, if you increase your TAM and you have a track record and showing that you're able to do that, that can be incredibly strong. So we're happy to take that investment. Because again, it's not about just cutting costs and being profitable. In my world, it is not, in my mind, but you know, we frequently discuss it, and I know we have a very good debate on it and a slightly different view on it, but I think as long as you're able to show that it pays off and that it compounds over time, very happy to forego profitability today in order to be more profitable and obviously much bigger in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious.
I potentially would say I'd be a bit more on the conservative side alert once it's like brutally focused on what you can control. And so certainly looking at current times, it's always the question. And I actually, one of my cases I like a lot was like the Oldenburgische Landesbank. It's actually a case like in Germany where based, like Apollo is the investor. They build actually based on like Oldenburgische Landesbank seems already pretty sexy by name, perhaps not like big savings bank, but they built like something on it. And they found that cost is one of the key propositions in terms of the equity markets. So they said cost is not only about negativity and I really have to save, but it's a strength. It's a core strength to really focus. So I really believe you can easier control elements in terms of spending. You can easier control elements of retention, then you potentially can estimate, especially with a long time frame, how much you have to spend to win new customers. And so again, it's not the topic that I'd say stop everything in terms of getting new customers, but it's much more also where I totally believe in that in current times, a lot of people are always seeing cost and profitability still based on like 2021 times as something, oh my goodness, I have to go into it. But it can really be considered also like as a strength.
All right.
Maybe to add also here that, I mean, the way I looked at the numbers, the growth numbers, was like, I didn't care whether this comes from new customers or from existing customers, right? The upsell. We all know that upselling to existing customers is around 6 times less effort. So the customer acquisition cost for that amount that you get in is by far less than with new customers. So if you make sure you retain your existing customers properly and you challenge your sales organization why the hell they're not selling the additional modules that we already have out there, right? You would do a bad job if you didn't do that. So yes, so the point is expansion dollars are from a growth rate perspective as well as net new dollars. Yeah?
Yeah, would agree with that. Yeah. So let's take, actually, one of you mentioned it before, rule of 40, right? I mean, this was the name of the game in the good times. I guess all of you know the rule of 40, or do we need a quick, no? So basically this was the rule for the startups, how they basically were told or how they learned to manage their company. So if you have a 20%, let's say 40, of course, 40%, if you have a 20% growth, this means that you have to have a 20% EBIT, right? But you can turn the 40 as you like. So if you basically have more aggressive growth, right, this obviously means that that you have to, well, more aggressive growth means actually that you can afford actually more investment in growth, right? So basically, I remember Rolf many times saying, well, you know, the rule of 40, we are still in good shape. Actually, we of course, we grow heavily, so we have negative EBIT, which is you burn money, right? So did that change to some extent now, or are you still running, I mean, Paolo as well, and of course, how you manage your companies, do you still run it by, let's say, I heard many times, I heard the statement, well, you know, we grow so nicely, actually, our very, very negative EBIT doesn't matter at all. We still hit the 40, right? So if you grow by 40, this means basically you don't need to grow. If you grow by 80, you can actually have a 40% negative EBIT, right? How do you run it? Was that a change from prior 21 to now?
I mean, to be confirmed, obviously, by Zoe and Julian, who are the one that pilot more the ship from that point of view. But I will say the rule stayed meaningful. Of course, the expectations around the number that you hit, have to shift. Like, again, in the good times, thinking I'm going to be the 40% growth company, so you know, EBIT can be zero, yeah. Or I go over and then EBIT can be negative and I'm good. In these times, playing, 50%, especially at scale, playing 40% growth, it's a very tough play. Like, I mean, it's good if you have it, but of course, in the current climate, it might be difficult. So what I think is, but I think the guidance of where we stand in the balance of these two factors, in my opinion, stays important. Again, you know, is the right number 40? That's maybe arguable, but I think from the point of view, what's the balance that you have between these two factors? Because obviously what is a nightmare is if your growth is not high and your EBIT is not that looking good, you are not up for a good journey in these days. So that's what I think. It's still a very super rough because, of course, like once you've seen the number, there is a lot of digging to understand what the company is actually doing and how it's going. But I think it's not bad using it as a ballpark thinking of, in which configuration are we as a company? And do we have these to be a balance and not to be somewhere that is completely out of the range in a bad place? Also, I will say, is not to get maybe the case to get too enthusiastic about, well, I'm just going to focus on EBIT, because unless we are talking about very big numbers, probably you wouldn't turn out to be a super exciting company should the turn of the market come. But, so I would say we still think about it. Again, you know, is the right number 40? That's a bit the peak that you need to think about
so
for
you
your company.
You want to lower it?
But yeah, maybe, you know, there is a moment for being gamble and thinking that you can also sit safely somewhere else. And that's also a conversation that you can test by, again, speaking with investors or other people to really reason about, well, how would we put it in perspective? So I would say, for us, it changed how we think about it. Again, you know, times have been very aggressive and expectations were super high. But we still think it's good to use as a way to understand, well, how are we doing and what are we shooting for? Still, I think can help some high-level target setting.
Before I ask the others to basically give their statement, there's one thing when you said 40, growth 40, we basically are, you know, kind of break even. It's still a super tough thing when you grow a business above the 100 million, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
at scale, numbers
this is
add up.
A discussion we have later, you know, for whom does this kind of, you know, growth story with retention, or for whom does it make sense, right? So assuming, right, you have a 200 million business, right, to grow this by 40% and at the same time be profitable, who has done it before? So that's the point.
It's a tough game.
We've seen it. You've seen it before? Yeah. But in Germany? Good. So then tell us more about that, because this is really something what I honestly, I mean, this is a tough play, right? Growing by 40% in a 200 million business at the same time, you know, sustain a, let's say, profitable type or even a profitable business. Go for your statement.
I can't disclose the names of the companies, but yeah, no, I've definitely seen it before. I mean, basically, that's what I've always been looking for, to be honest. Growth at scale, and maybe taking a step back as to why that is, why what I've been looking for and continue to look for. And by the way, I think that Europe is ideally positioned to create these kind of companies. Is that when you plot out the numbers in public markets as to where you get premium valuations, and if you do the same exercise on private transactions, you will see that, as you correctly said, there's a premium being paid for companies that continue to grow, let's say 30% and are roughly profitable. So you have a bit of leeway as to how you really interpret the numbers, but there's this basically what you should aim for at scale. And I mean, we've seen companies like Klaviyo IPO recently, and I don't have the exact numbers in mind, but they were definitely way north of like the 200 million. I think it was 500, you probably know better, 500 million or so in ARR. We weren't investors, so I don't know exactly, but huge ARR level, 30% growth, very good net retention. So exactly what you're looking for. Now, this is exceptional. And these are companies that are truly mission critical, that have nailed the product work with their customer base, and that have been able to expand the TAM, and which is why I'm coming back to this point of investment in product. If you want to build these kind of regional or global category leaders, there's just no way around it, because you have to start by obviously making sure your product works across the globe, and then you have to make sure it works across customer segments. And then once you're able to do that, there's such an interesting motion, and it's, you know, everything but easy going from, you know, enterprise to mid-market, or moving the other way around. Both comes with its challenges, but there's so many ways to expand TAM. And again, proving that by continuously staying innovative, investing in products, something that we've seen many times, and that is hugely attractive at scale.
This is a very important statement, I think, for the audience here. If you run a growth company and you hear what Zoe said, I think it's very good. Thank you.
Yeah. So now... But looking also at the topic, I wouldn't agree that it's only like really challenging for a large company to come to the rule of 40. Mm-hmm. So I think this is, again, the question about talking what is good, what is very good, and what is great. So I think every company that is at a rule of 40 is something that is pretty good. Because first of all, I wouldn't so much say which side is it coming from. Is it from growth or is it from the efficiency side? Because to be honest, and I had a good conversation last night also with an investor who said, in reality, as I said earlier, it's great times for great companies. Companies that are currently having great KPIs, the ones you were just referring to, like being really big, still growing very, very stellar, they always got great valuation and still do. The only topic is there are less there. And to be honest, also in 2021, nobody looked anymore at some of these KPIs and these ratios. So you had a lot of companies that were growing tremendously, but I don't know, they spent per kind of euro they added in terms of ARR, I don't know, hundreds, thousands or whatever of euros again. And this is kind of the topic where I like the rule of 40, and I would shift it, of course, more to the upper end, saying if you find companies that are going to rule of 60, 70, and they are out there as well. That's real. They are out there as well. And some of them even are coming from profitable companies being in the right space. And again, about the topic, what you can control, in reality, it's also about market and timing. Because looking at being in current times, also some elements about climate, but also risk methods in terms of being in the times where a lot of regulation and things are hitting in, that can help you tremendously getting in there. So I wouldn't take the bar too low, but of course, also saying everybody, doesn't matter how big the company is, being able to achieve a rule of 40 is quite an achievement.
Just one more comment. As far as I learned, the rule of 40 applies to companies beyond 5, better 10 million euro ARR. How many companies have more than 10 million euro ARR in this room? Here you go. Yeah. Forget the rule of 40. Look at other KPIs and then care about the rule of 40 afterwards. Look at customer acquisition cost. Look at payback in months. Those are the KPIs that you can control and you need to optimize, and then take care about the rule of 40 when you became that big.
Actually, this puts actually our discussion a little bit into perspective. I said, well, I haven't seen companies growing by 40% and being profitable, because I come from the super early stage, right? So I grow companies up to whatever, 40, 50 million, not more. So it comes actually from the higher side, right, and says, "Well, this is normal." And you actually put but it's possible. That's what you said, right? And Rolf, actually, what you say now actually puts this exactly in the right perspective. If you're a small company, you don't need to worry about the rule of 40 that much, right? Yeah. So now I think before we move into real down to the bone, you know, in terms of retention versus growth, we have a few minutes more to do that. I think we should define the ISTP first. Can someone start? Oh, you don't know that acronym. I'll be honest with you, I defined it. I wanted to define one acronym myself once at least. So it's, instead of the ideal customer profile, I define an ideal startup profile for focusing on retention. Because, I mean, we heard this statement many times, you know, it's not for every company. If you have only 10 customers, I mean, you know, why should you only invest on retention? It doesn't make any sense, right? So this is probably for all of you, but let's do it a little bit condensed, because we have then actually, once we have the ideal startup profile, we then discuss a little bit more, you know, what kind of actions can you undertake to increase actually your retention. So who wants to start with the ISTP definition or sketching it?
I can only briefly. For me, it's very different if you are a company focusing on large enterprise where retention, and if you can get like to a couple of millions per customer, versus being more on the SMB side of things, where certainly new acquisition is totally different. Very different for industries. Sticky industries, for example, government, topics like also like financial service, totally different again to e-commerce, potentially some of these elements. So I'd say the more kind of larger ACVs, the larger enterprise segments, the more retention by nature is something I'd potentially focus on, again, to your point, in a growth stage, then actually turning it around, actually the more you are like longer tail or something like that.
Anyone else wants to add to our ideal startup profile for heavy retention?
Yeah, maybe one thought just to complement what you said, which I obviously fully second, is the ratio or is the efficiency of spend. I mean, if you're a company that has to just spend a lot of money to even acquire the customers, or even on the SMB side has like a high churn built in, like I would definitely also watch out for that. I mean, now we're talking about software, but you know, obviously, there's also a couple of kind of consumer intimate models where you see that as well. So I think it's generally also always good to think about the efficiency. And as soon as you realize that this, you know, can be painful, it's a good moment to actually start focusing on it.
Okay. So I may do a stupid math now, but you definitely correct me, I'm sure. So assuming now, let's take Contentful and RiskMethod as an example. You both have happy customers, right? But it's also, of course, you get involved as well. So you have around about, let's say, 300K average annual recurring revenue per account, right? So your customers are all happy. But now you want to implement a heavy retention strategy, right? So how do you want to achieve growth? The customers are already, let's say, relatively happy. You already have 300K, 400, 500K per customer. How can you get them to the 95%? I made this statement before, and to be honest with you, I didn't invent this 95% growth on revenues, because I can't really give the answer to it, right? How does it work to get a 300, 400K from one customer to get this basically up that you can double your revenues? Any answers from the two of you?
No idea.
I agree. I mean, it is a super difficult play. Again, I think, you know, if you look at a business only from a retentive point of view and so on, it's a super limiting box to put yourself in. Not that mathematically you couldn't imagine your way there. Practically, how to execute on something like that is just not a plan, for many companies.
Yeah, I would question the necessity of growth, honestly. It really depends on your current situation. Especially in the times we are now, you don't have to please investors, because probably there is anyway no exit option. So the way I would look at it, no, seriously, no, you have to please your own company and your employees, yeah, to make sure that they are happy with the company, and you should leverage those times today in order to become more efficient, because there's 100%, there's many, many construction sites inside your company that you can tackle in order to increase your efficiency, even if the growth rate drops down to 10%, yeah? But you're not selling the company anyway in the next 12 months. So if you focus on efficiency, and that would be my call to action, right, in those times, focus on efficiency, get the clear path to profitability, and then repress the gas pedal in 12 to 15 months again. When you sell probably the company in 24 or 36 months at decent growth rates again, but at a very, very great efficiency rate, I mean, that's what I would do at the moment.
Yeah. How would you measure it? We're talking about, of course, everyone talks about growth, retention or net retention. What's the right parameter? I heard this actually many people asking also during the conference here. What should we really focus on? Should we look at our NRR or should we look actually at our growth retention rate?
I mean, maybe the answer will be unsatisfactory, both, because I think if you look at the net retention, you might be fooling yourself because you might be losing business, still gaining it, and have a super expensive mechanic where, again, overall the number looks good, but you're doing exactly a lot of work for that number. So I think looking at what the business you retain, and in the context of retention, what's your expansion in the business that you're doing, and looking at both is really the way to guide yourself. And but for sure is, like, you know, the net retention is almost, I would say, you know, comes first. Like, I really, really want to curate that name and think in terms of what's my net retention, to not cut out the discussion to the, I just want to keep what I have. Like, I want to build in the relationship of the customer. And again, maybe it doesn't work if you really work with very small businesses or individuals, because you don't have so much possibility to expand in there. But for businesses that instead, again, work with you know, medium and large companies, that's something to keep an eye.
I would also say, to the point what you just said in terms of what you can afford, actually, in times of these, if you can't afford, and it's just the question, because in current times you don't have funding, the theory and like the school book answer would be in efficient times, potential retention. But if you can afford to play offense, and then to your point, in terms of course, doing both, because the question is, and we had this discussion before, if you only focus on retention and at the end you end up with one customer, then it's kind of the question without this point.
This is actually one of the points. Actually, most of you, hopefully every one of you knows the difference between net retention and growth retention. So we are talking and talking here, and just don't want to lose the people here. So very quickly, basically, if you have net retention, means that if you lose customers, but some of your existing customers just upsell, basically, or you can upsell, you can have a net retention rate which is higher than 100%. Growth obviously means that you just take basically what you lose, but you exclude actually the extensions, right? So it can maximum be 100%, right? So in my opinion, this is exactly the joke that we made, actually. Net retention rate is a little bit dangerous because you can become a little bit blind. If you look, basically, actually I'm the moderator, but maybe I want to do this statement because I watched this as well, but I think it's dangerous because I hear startups saying, well, Alexander, it works well, we have 120% net retention rate, right? And the joke that Julian just made, at the end of the day, it means you're losing customers, but you're still increasing your existing customers' revenue because some of the existing customers pay more. And the joke that we made is, one fine day, someone rings at your bell and says, by the way, I'm your only last customer. I do pay a lot. I'm a 5 million customer for you, but you only have one customer left. Of course, this is placative. It's a joke. But this is the problem with net retention revenue. You don't really see how good am I doing with keeping my customers. You may be good making a very few customers very, very happy, but that's also not a growth business, right? So growth retention is not unimportant. But you want to challenge it? Please.
Not necessarily. I just want to add to it. Thinking about what can be useful for, you know, the founders here in this audience, is to really go very granular in the way you kind of hold your data and analyze it, because people will look at gross retention and net retention. We all know what the numbers should be at scale. It's above 95% one, above 100, 125, 130% for the other at scale. But you'll also want to look at logo and ARR level data for both, which is really interesting, and you will have also considerations when you speak about churn. Is it actually contraction or is it churn? I mean, let's not forget we're in a software recession, so there's obviously also some contraction going on, and really understanding the dynamics and getting all that data is something that is extremely valuable, and tracking that early on and over time and really trying to see what you optimize for on the efficiency is something that will definitely pay off in the investor conversations you have and will be much appreciated by any investor, because that's precisely the work that people want to do.
Thank you. Segmentation. We're talking about retention, right? So how can I improve my retention? And remember, Paolo, we had a discussion long before, actually, on segmentation, and I think you have a strong opinion. So you want to share that with us here? You know, what do you need to do in order to drive a really, let's say, very successful retention? You need to segment your customers?
Yeah, I mean, there, of course, you know, being sure that you are a solution that is specific for the customer is important. I think, I mean, segmentation can obviously assume many forms. Like, there are businesses where you want to segment, I don't know, by vertical. In our case, we are a platform. Content is quite a transversal business, so we segment rather on use cases. And there, going back to the efficiency, I think also there is something in product design on how your product can somehow be used to segment without actually doing much more work in the product. Like, you know, because the nightmare is if I have 5 segments and essentially I end up with 5 different products because I have 1 per segment, that's not an efficient way of doing things. Like, you don't have many synergies. Instead, if you have a platform where it's like, well, I can somehow sell a solution that is 95% of the same thing, but as the 5% that cater to my vertical dimension, whatever that is, you know, vertical in the market or vertical in the use case, that can be a very powerful way of, again, saying we are a solution specific for you, and have much more likelihood of being retained because the customer feels you're fitting, you're really helping. So that can be a strategy. And connected to that, there is also the go-to-market. It can be something that you can segment and you can make specific, and that's again something that can work more efficiently than segmenting the products in having literally different lines. So I think is an intriguing dimension to think about. Again, when times change, are there changes that you can operate on that axis? I think that's interesting.
Yes, thanks for joining me here till the end. I think it was a group of very strong supporters and great people from the ecosystem, and always good to hear what they think, but also sometimes what they have been thinking about and compared to the present. So I hope you enjoyed that little recap, and maybe we see each other in Frankfurt and in the next upcoming Artist Summit pre-event stop. And other than that, I wish you a fantastic week. Cheers.